greetings to you all. I like to think of Insight Myanmar Podcast as a community platform. This community includes everyone behind the production, as well as the incredible guests we welcome on, and also encompasses the tens of thousands of listeners like yourself tuning in from all around the world. In essence, this production is really a conversation that we're all part of. So whether we're the ones who happen to be doing the talking, listening, asking questions, or just reflecting, we hope that this community feel can foster deeper understanding, shared learning, and meaningful connections, all centered around the stories and experiences of our guests. And that begins with the conversation coming up right now. So thank you for joining us for what's ahead.
Hello, listeners. This is Itan Zain. I will be your host for today's episode on Inside Myanmar Podcast. Today, we have Mark Famana, and I briefly talked to Mark in my past life as a journalist for Voice of America, but that was years ago. And then we talked about the coup and also sanctions from US and UK. And different statements, but this episode is, you know, more than that, and we will talk more about it later. But before jumping into your role as a director for Burma Campaign UK, Mark, I want to ask you, how did it all begin?
Well, I became aware of the situation in Burma around the same time many people around the world did, which was the coup in 1988. At the time, I was involved in the anti-apartheid campaign. There was a picket outside the South African Embassy in Trafalgar Square, London, for the freedom of Nelson Mandela, the leader of the democracy movement there. And I remember we were sitting one morning. We used to be there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we were sat there one morning after a freezing cold overnight shift, even though it was August and it shouldn't have been, and we were reading the newspaper about the fact that the uprising in Burma had brought down the military there, the military regime had collapsed, and so this gave us hope. This gave us hope that something similar could happen in South Africa. The regime there could fall. Obviously, that's not what happened. There was another military regime replaced the old one in Burma, and it was in South Africa where shortly afterwards there was dramatic change and democracy finally arrived. So I followed Burma in the news when it was in the news ever since, and then I was volunteering at a development agency, Christian Aid, in the late 1990s, and the head of the campaign section there was the John Jackson, the co-founder of Burma Action Group, as it was called then, and he asked me to start volunteering. So I began volunteering, I think, in 1998, and then moved to work at Burma Campaign UK in 2001.
So it started, you've seen more than one coup in Myanmar.
Yes, unfortunately, yes.
The reality of it is that it is way too many coups in Myanmar that we've experienced. And, how do you feel about that?
Well, the way we describe it now, because a lot of For Burma Campaign UK, our audience, our job is to educate the international community, to influence the international community. And so, when you have these narratives that the military was reforming or had reformed or is going to reform or there's reformers waiting in the wings, we have to keep reminding them that they keep having coups, and this is just the latest coup. And so we frame it like that. This is just the latest coup, and it's going to keep happening. And as long as the military are allowed to have any form of power or influence, it's just a question of time before there'll be another one. So, when we're talking to governments and they're saying, "Oh, what the solution to the current crisis is dialogue with the military," what they mean is compromise with the military, and that is just setting the timer to the next coup. So it's not a solution.
Right. So you think we shouldn't compromise with different governments that come up after the coups?
Well, we talked to a lot of people in the country who, and there was a lot of people, I think, particularly in the ethnic states, who even during the Thein Sein so-called good times, we're seeing an increase in conflict in some areas, who weren't seeing the benefits that some people in other parts of the country saw, who were saying, we just need to get rid of the military completely. And I think a lot more people that we speak to now just say, we have to remove the military. They can't have any kind of role. If there's any kind of compromise with them where they're meant to stay out of politics or sort of have reduced power or a slow transition, there'll just be another coup again, because that's what they keep doing. And in the current circumstances where the military are losing, then dialogue and a compromise is like throwing a lifeline to the military. They're in deep trouble, and if they keep losing territory, if the current trajectory carries on, then some sort of internationally brokered dialogue and compromise will save them at a chance when people in the country have finally got a chance to get rid of them. So, when I'm going up and down the Thai border, when I'm sneaking across the border and talking to people, talking to people from London across the country, it's a big fear of people is that they're saying to us is that they'll be forced into some kind of compromise with their oppressor, and that will throw the military a lifeline. It's so that's a message that we're passing on to governments in Europe and around the world is, when you call for inclusive dialogue, what you're saying is compromise with your oppressor again, and that's never worked.
Right. Yeah. The coup keep happening over and over again. And what was your first experience working on Myanmar? Is it the 1990s, the 88 coup?
Yeah, so that's when I first became aware. In the late 1990s, there was the anniversary of the coup was the big opportunity, because Burma was not in the news at all. Most people in the UK didn't even know where Burma is. It could have been in South America for all they knew. And so the anniversary was an opportunity. We would hold some kind of protest or stunt or event every year on the anniversary, designed to get the media to cover it, to get some politicians involved, and just to have a chance to get some attention on the country, because there just was none. And but there were also campaigns, particularly on gas revenue, because we could see, the gas revenue that was going to come online, was going to be such a lifeline for the military and enable them to scale up, their military purchases, which, we later saw with their first MiG jet purchases on the down payments from gas, which we can see how they've used air power since the coup against the population. So there was a British company, Premier Oil, involved, but we were lobbying other companies as well that were involved in gas extraction and trying to persuade governments to sanction that sector then, but we were not successful.
With the latest coup right now too, the international media attention, well, there's only so much people can care about, right? Like the new conflict comes up, new crises come up, and people's attention span is very short. And I'm sure it's different from the 90s when social media or media looks something a little different. I want to know, like, what kind of stunts or what kind of statements or what kind of action did get people's attention at that time, and how is it different from how we're doing things now?
Well, I mean, it was very, very little attention in the late 90s. So when we had a parade, we hired an open-top bus. We worked with members of the Burmese community in the UK and London, and we had a sort of a parade of cars led by a bus, trying to get some celebrities and politicians there so that the media would be drawn to watching that. And we went around central London. People were leafleting to raise awareness. Another year, we kind of staged, members of the Burmese community staged a massacre with some dressed as soldiers and some as protesters who were shot. Again, that was a visual that the media were interested in, so we managed to get onto television and some newspapers for that. But it was very hard. I think when the two things that sort of drew international attention later on were Aung San Suu Kyi and when we started to work much more on the British economic connections to the military, the British companies that were doing business in Burma in a way which was helping to finance the military. And, you know, the high street names, the shops and other companies that had some financial link to the military, that generated a lot of media interest, and that then led to more political interest. But of course, the figurehead Aung San Suu Kyi was the main attraction. She had a profile. People couldn't never say who she was. They say, "Isn't there that? That's the country of that woman. What's her name?" But at least they were aware that was a starting point. And so those were the two factors that started in the early 2000s to enable us to start putting Burma up, the UK, and working with a network of human rights organizations across Europe and the world, then sort of pushing Burma up the political international agenda.
So do you think that Aung San Suu Kyi still have that kind of pull from international media and attention?
Not really now. In fact, it's the opposite. I think that a lot of media and celebrities, people that were supporting the situation in Burma, the people of Burma, inspired by Aung San Suu Kyi, later felt burned by that because of the controversy around her position on the Rohingya, political prisoners remaining in jail. And now you have a new generation of politicians who've only known of Aung San Suu Kyi as the controversy from 2012 onwards, and going to The Hague at the ICJ hearings, and don't know of her as the hero of people of Burma and someone who inspired people around the world by her resistance to the military. So it works the other way now. Earlier this year, we put out a media release highlighting the fact that Aung San Suu Kyi had now spent a total of 19 years in jail, and nobody was interested. Wow. 19 years in detention overall, and it didn't get any attention at all. I think that has been made international advocacy. The damage to her reputation, her actions while she was in government, have made the international advocacy a lot harder. But also we're up against much bigger challenges now with the situation in Ukraine and Gaza. There were always things where we were trying over the years, where we were trying to get Burma higher up the political agenda and we were starting to get more coverage, and then there'd be an international crisis and it sort of knocked us off. But overall, the course was that, you know, Burma was moving up the international agenda, and you saw that during the same years, why you had presidents and prime ministers from all over the world flocking to the country is because, you know, there was that big international awareness of the situation. But it's very, very challenging now. I think also another challenge is there isn't the same international coordination for advocacy. There's a lot of different advocacy messages out there now. There isn't, you know, there used to be much clearer coordination between, Burmese communities worldwide, by organizations on the Thai-Burma border and the coalitions they had, the Burma Campaign UK, US Campaign for Burma and others, and the big international human rights organizations. We would get clearer messages from the movement of what our key priorities should be that we could all work on at the same time. And so international advocacy was very well coordinated. We would all work together on the same issue at the same time. We wouldn't be trying to push on too many issues at once. And so we were able to make big, big change. We got Burma onto the agenda of the UN Security Council, against all the odds on that. And, but that's what, when you had the united advocacy, you can achieve. And there isn't that at the moment. There isn't that. And I think part of the reason that is a lot of the civil society groups and others that used to be working on advocacy, their capacity is now soaked up by the humanitarian crisis and the situation on the ground. We've seen a big change in that. When we go and meet with organizations we've been working with, supporting for more than 20 years, their focus isn't on the international advocacy anymore like it used to be, because the situation on the ground is so horrific and they're dealing, just struggling to deal with that.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Myanmar, and I came to the United States when I, just for college, right? And then I noticed the shift in how much or how much people care about Burma. And, I went to a small liberal arts college in the middle of nowhere in Virginia, and they don't know where Burma is. They're like, Alabama? No, I said, I'm from Burma. And slowly there was some interest from, in Burma. And also, yes, like you said, someone somewhere knows about Aung San Suu Kyi. Isn't that the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, the lady? And, I moved to DC to work in more traditional media. And, those were good days, 2013, 2015, 2016 even. So the public opinion shift has changed on our country and also Aung San Suu Kyi as well. And, working in a traditional media too, I have seen things from a different lens. And also living in DC, people know about my country. Some of them know even more than me, as when I move here. So it's so much to learn, so many discussion to go on. And I was wondering, since you've been working, wearing many hats, you also work as a director for Justice for Rohingya UK. So, when working in tandem with Burma issue, Rohingya issue, and also, you also work for the Karen, the foundation that you work at. So many different layered issue exist in Myanmar. I know that you're well versed in it, but for somebody who's new, coming into, Myanmar sphere, wanting to learn more about it, how difficult is it to explain about it? Because I have encountered so many difficult conversations on Ubers. They would be like, oh, Myanmar, isn't that the lady horrible? Isn't she a hero? And how do you navigate those questions? Since, I'm sure you get that all the time, trying to tell people this is not a one-sided issue.
So it's very challenging. And so I think one of the things is the main audience for Burma Campaign UK is British public, British and European politicians and governments. And it's even surprising when you go into some foreign ministries how little they know or understand about what's going on. And so we have to simplify our messaging. And I think it's different now with social media. Everything is out there. And so our message sometimes, when we're messaging the British public who know very little, and we simplify things, that we then get criticized by some people from Burma because we haven't been nuanced enough. But you can't do that when someone barely knows where the country is. We do have to sum up the situation in a way that's easy to understand, but at the same time try and we always try to get people to understand it's not just about there is good guy Aung San Suu Kyi, bad guy Burmese military, and that's it, and that it's, you know, it's a lot more complex than that. And I suppose one way we try to describe it to people is to say the challenge is, you know, different visions of what Burma is. Is Burma a sort of a Burma Buddhist country with minorities, or is it a multi-ethnic, multi-religious country? And where you lead on either of those sort of can, you know, can tell you where the politics are coming from. So I think that Burma is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious country, and but a lot of people don't see it as that. And I think, you know, when I met with Aung San Suu Kyi and discussed with her, I certainly got the impression from her she sees it, Burma, as a Burma Buddhist country with minorities, and that focus. And then that shapes everything that she then, her whole approach and other people's approach is shaped from that starting point.
When did you meet her? Is it before or after the ICJ?
So it is in 2012. I had three meetings with her in 2012.
Mm-hmm. And so that's when she said, think that it is more Burma majority with other ethnic minorities.
So it was when we were talking to her about, I'd just been to Liza and Majayang. I've been, you know, by then, you know, I had many years, I've been making trips to the Thai-Burma border and across the border into Shan State, Karen State, to, you know, the border with Kareni State, and across the border from China into Kachin State. And, you know, been meeting IDPs, people who have been fleeing military attacks. And what struck me about, you know, in the visit in early 2012 is the intensity. It's usually that a lot of IDPs that you meet, they heard fighting was happening, they were near it, and they ran away first. But in 2012, people didn't have that chance. Or, you know, a much larger proportion of the IDPs that I met and spoke with had directly witnessed and experienced human rights violations. It was much more intense. And I was trying to explain that to Aung San Suu Kyi, but she cut me off and saying, oh, they're all as bad as each other, basically, which I was quite surprised at. So then when we tried to sort of follow up on that a bit, that's when I did understand that, yeah, her perception of the country is as a Burma Buddhist country with minorities and not the other way around. And that was clearly informing. So when she was talking about the relationships with ethnic people, she said, oh, we have very good relationships with ethnic political parties. They always do what we want. And that's how she saw it, the relationship, as one where they did what she wanted them to do. In that meeting, yeah, there were a few things she said then when we were concerned, because the root cause of the problem is, you know, the original coup in 62 happened relating to concerns about devolution that the military had, and that, you know, addressing the whole crisis in the country, you have to address the legitimate concerns and experiences that ethnic people have had at the hands of central governments and the military, not just the military, but central governments as well, and the discrimination they faced. And in our discussions with her, we didn't feel that she really understood that at all. She didn't get it, and she didn't want to sort of hear much about it either.
Right. So do you think she was working in the direction that you would have wanted to go if her government still stand today and the coup didn't happen? She had plans, you know, she made promises in campaigning for her new election that we all voted for, and that the vote doesn't count, right? Like, so if our votes counted and her plan worked? Do you think it is part of her plan to make it a federal country?
Well, and that's what she was saying. But you know, the ethnic political leaders we were talking to would say it was still a very much a top-down approach. I think, you know, it was revealing on, I think it was a trip to Sweden when she complained to, I think, politicians there that ethnic political leaders seem to think that this is some kind of negotiation. You know, she wanted to impose, you know, her solution, you know, the kind of federalism that she wanted. That's what she wanted to impose. And she, you know, that's what she said to them. They seem to think it's some kind of negotiation, which it was, but that's not how she was perceiving it. So, and she didn't deliver on a lot of those things. And there was a lot of frustration from ethnic politicians, because of it, and they did feel that she didn't really understand their situation and their experience and what they'd been through. So, and we were encouraging her, for example, to go to the IDP camps, yeah, in November 2012, and met her then, and go to the IDP camps where displaced Rohingya were, and to see for herself what's going on and the situation there, which she refused to do.
Yeah. Right now, there's about 1 million or more Rohingya refugees in Cox's Bazar, right? That's the largest refugee camp. And, you know, we also hear, well, until recently when I was covering stories, I see a lot of stories on how Rohingya population is trying to get out of the refugee camps because their entire livelihood, sometimes, you know, some kids were born there, they were raised there, and there's no real infrastructure on their ways to make money. And, you know, they try to go to a third country. And get a lot of organizations, a lot of countries are helping it, including humanitarian aids from US and UK. You know, the humanitarian foreign aid kind of view from United States is shaky, to say the least, right? You know, the current Trump administration has started seeing that as unnecessary spending, which it should be reduced or cut or, you know, just trim the fat. And you work in UK, has the UK government have similar ideas? Because I see that globally, a lot of leaders are starting to put, quote unquote, their country first.
But the UK already cut aid massively in 2021, and that sort of overall aid, international aid budget, led to a 73% cut in UK aid to Rohingya and the refugee camps and to Burma as a whole. And I think there was a pattern as well, because the international aid budgets for Burma, Myanmar had grown. Because they say, oh, we're supporting a transition to democracy. But a lot of that was not on the humanitarian crisis, this for IDPs and refugees. It was development assistance working sort of through and with the government. And after the coup in 2021, they took the opportunity to just cut that development assistance. They didn't switch it over, despite this massively increasing humanitarian need. They just cut the aid budget, and that, you know, also coincided with the UK with significant budget cuts as well. So we saw the EU, Germany, UK, other countries were all reduced their overall aid budget to Burma because they didn't switch development assistance over to humanitarian assistance. Because they all stopped the development assistance once the coup had happened. And so we've been lobbying in the UK to get them to increase the budget, and they have started to increase the budget again. But now the new Labour government here has announced again massive cuts to the overall aid budget. And we're lobbying now that that Burma should be protected from those cuts because of the exceptional multiple crises hitting the country at the same time. It looks like this year's financial budget, hopefully, you know, that will be okay, but it's when the big cuts come in the next financial year in April next year, then that's when we're going to have, you know, to see what actually happens. We'll be doing everything we can to lobby the British government not to do that. But you can see the disaster of it is that, you know, the Burmese military are deliberately creating a humanitarian crisis. They've always done that. They've done that for decades in ethnic states. They're doing it across the country now because it soaks up the capacity of the resistance movement, the democracy movement, the human rights activists. And that's what, you know, I was saying earlier, the human rights activists who used to be focused on a lot of international advocacy are now, you know, their focus is mainly on responding to the humanitarian crisis. And so when you have these cuts in international aid, then that is going to benefit the Burmese military, because it means that the resistance is weakened and more of the focus and resources are taken up dealing with the humanitarian crisis. So yeah, the US aid cuts, the UK aid cuts, that's something that, you know, Burmese military will be celebrating. We did see Burmese military social media accounts, you know, celebrating when the US cut VOA funding, when the US cut US aid funding. They, you know, they were gloating about it on social media, on their sort of proxy sock puppet channels and others, because it's good news for them. And it couldn't come at a worse time, because, you know, I think one interesting thing, things are so awful in the country at the moment, but then when I, you know, visit the cross-border trip or trips to the border, there's more hope than before as well, because, you know, people have worn down, they're desperate, the situation is awful, they're exhausted, but there is also hope, and people are talking about a future without the Burmese military, and people think there, you know, that there is an actual chance of that happening now for the first time in decades. And the aid cuts,
how do they express that? You know, did you meet people who, like, how are they more hopeful than before? I mean, you know, it is quite, you know, it's not double whammy, it's more than that. There's like so many, one crisis after another hitting Myanmar, you know, the earthquake, flood, coup, you know, another one. So that is, you know, we are being labeled as resilient. You know, Burmese people are so resilient, and also they are, you know, very optimistic, right? So I wasn't there in the border, but you've met a lot of people, and I want to know how they express that they feel more hopeful than before.
Well, I think first time I really noticed that 2 years ago, going up and down the border, meeting with a lot of people, and I've been going up to the sort of Thai-Burma border, crossing from China into Kachin State for 20 years, and, you know, 2 years ago, every single meeting, and it was the first time that had ever happened in 20 years, every single meeting, people were talking about a future without the military, after the military, what they wanted to do, the problems that they would face after the military. And that had never, I don't think that had ever come up, well, apart from formal meetings about a new constitution and things that used to take place in a more academic way. It had never happened before. I'd never been there where everyone was talking about what would replace the military, whether it was what we're going to do in Karen State, what we're going to do in Sagai, what we're going to do in Karen State, what would be in sort of government moving back to Yangon and what would happen there. That's what people were all talking about, the future and hope. So, and which I'd never experienced before. And so, but now, you know, more recently, yeah, that hope is still there, but, you know, it's taking longer than people hoped, the progress that people hoped they would be making in taking more territory, China's intervention and sort of more forceful support for the military now compared to what was there. So spirit, I wouldn't say that there is, spirits are high or people are really optimistic, but there is still that hope. There is that feeling that there is a chance of getting rid of the military when I'm talking to people, which, you know, people didn't really talk about before.
So. Yeah, like at the beginning, you said that, you know, there is no role for a military and there's no compromise. compromising with the oppressor, right? So the future that we're so looking forward without the military, what does it look like and what does it take for us to get there?
I think so. This is one of the other challenges now, because you have diplomats who say, oh, they almost blame people in the country. They're saying, oh, you should be united. When political forces in their own country are not united, they might not be fighting, but they're not united. And you can see division, internal division growing across the world now. But there seems to be an expectation that somehow all the diverse people of the country with different experiences, different challenges, should all unite under one common leader or authority to resist the military together, which is just not, that demonstrates a real lack of understanding of how the country works. And
it's not realistic.
And it's totally unrealistic. But also I think it's missing the point, because I think we always used to joke about how many different coalitions and organizations they were. And in fact, when I joined Burma Campaign UK, there was one member of the Burmese community in London said to me, if you want to understand my country, you have to understand this joke. You know, what do you get if you put two Burmese people in a room for an hour? Three organizations. And I didn't understand that at all, but oh my God, I do now. But there were all these coalitions, these formal coalitions of civil society, of ethnic armed organizations, and multiple ones. And there still are some on paper. But actually, what you're seeing now is that people are all working together without these formal structures. And you've got different ethnic armed organizations, revolutionary organizations, sending their forces to neighboring states or states further away to help them at a critical moment when they're trying to defend something or take something. They're calling each other up on Signal. They're not sitting around with a committee and a subcommittee and there is a remarkable amount of communication, coordination, information sharing going on behind the scenes between the different ethnic, revolutionary and armed organizations. And with PDFs and others as well, and with different civil society organizations. And we're trying to explain to governments, and some of them are starting to get it, that there isn't going to be, if the military are just reduced to a rump area of the country, or if the military are defeated or collapse, whatever happens, the replacement isn't going to be a strong central government with authority all over the country. You're going to have multiple administrations all over the country, and you're going to have to deal with those multiple administrations for economically, for humanitarian assistance. And those administrations at the beginning are not going to cede any power to any central government. I think obviously at a later stage they will need to for investment, for infrastructure, energy, the different things that will be needed. But when you've had people who've been fighting for their land, their state, their resources for decades against the Burmese military, and for some of them, right the way through the so-called good days of the reform process of Thein Sein and the Aung San Suu Kyi government, the attacks never stopped, the army never left their streets. And so they're not going to just hand that over to an NLD, an NUG, or any other kind of central government. They're going to keep that, and they're going to run it themselves. And they will opt in. So it's going to be, rather than the central government ceding power or saying you can have this or you can have that, which, coming back to talking about Aung San Suu Kyi's approach, that was very much her approach, which caused a lot of resentment among different ethnic, political and armed leaders. You can see that the tables have turned in a way now, and it's some of these ethnic armed organizations, they can set their own terms, and they will be the ones choosing how much any central government can or can't be involved in the affairs of their state. But that doesn't, it doesn't mean there's going to be warlordism, Burma will be a failed state, or these kind of things that some of the international community are afraid of, because there will be multiple administrations. There are going to be flashpoints and clashes between some of them over territory and resources. there's going to be a tough time. It's going to be really, really difficult for a long time. But that's the legacy that you've got from these decades of military rule, of them playing divide and rule, and you know, and the policies of central governments as well. I think we need to get the international community to understand that you can't expect out of, you know, the unique situation in the country, some stable central government to sort of magically appear, or all the people of the country magically unite together and solve all the problems. It's not going to be like that. But just because it's going to be this Devomax unfamiliar structure for them doesn't mean that they need to be afraid of it and decide, well, we're going to side with the military, which I think is what China has decided now there. And some neighboring countries are worried about is, you know, the alternative to the Burmese military is going to be the country dissolving or failed states or this. But actually, you could have a reasonably stable state but made up of multiple administrations without a lot of the problems that they fear.
So the future of Myanmar without the military is not a centralized government, but a government that we don't usually see in other countries?
I think that's what you're already seeing now. You're seeing in different parts of the country, some parts like Wa and others, you've had this for a long time, and you've had, you know, ethnic armed organizations have had in their territories, they've had their own administrations providing services, justice, healthcare, schools, forestry, all these different things, you know, on a limited scale. And that's being scaled up now as the, you know, you've seen it in Karenni State with the Interim Executive Committee, you know, the Arakan Army, expanding its administrative power over more and more of a Rakhine State. So it's already starting to happen. I don't think it means there won't be a central government. And talking to, you know, some ethnic leaders, I think they feel like once we've got our state, that's it. We're done with it. We're not going to cross the border and die, you know, for a central government. But other leaders, they recognize that there needs to be a stable central government, and it's in their interests to support that happening. And they would be willing to support, you know, that, I think, and if that means sending their soldiers to help support a central government as part of that new system, I think then some of them are willing to do that.
The interim government, National Unity Government, was trying to replace whatever we had lost because of the coup. Do you think that would be in this future of Myanmar without the military? Is that in the cards?
I can't see them being able to form a central government of the kind that there was, you know, pre-coup. And I think we already saw that when there were some instances of them trying to establish administrations in some ethnic controlled areas in Karen State, and where they then got slapped down very hard by, you know, the ethnic organizations there saying, no, this is our area. You don't have the authority to do that here. And I think, yeah, I think the situation for them is hugely challenging. And, you know, there is unfair criticism of them from the international community and others. You know, they're trying to be a government when they don't have the sort of the finance, the capacity, the experience, and in a lot of cases to sort of properly administer any areas, the areas where, you know, in Sagaing State or others where they're trying to establish administrations in impossible situations where no one could really do so very easily. And when they don't get that right first time, then they face a lot of criticism for it. But I think they haven't managed to reach out successfully to the neighboring countries. So they've got support from sympathy from Western countries. But in the region, the neighboring countries, they haven't managed to reach out and convince them in the way that sort of would have been good if they'd been able to. And I don't know if that was always an impossible task anyway. But the, you know, the key influential countries, the neighboring countries, you know, they are still backing the military, or the ones that were sitting on the fence. The military has very successfully manipulated the earthquake situation to their advantage to sort of gain that legitimacy again now. So, you know, that these local governments, which the ASEAN countries, which were avoiding meeting with the military, are now willing to do so and give them that perceived legitimacy. So, yeah, it's hard to see where the NUG can go in terms of ever forming a central government when you've got, for example, NLD MPs and who've deliberately stayed away from the NUG and are sort of biding their time, saying they are the legitimate ones and the NUG has no legitimacy and we are the elected ones and that's it. There's a lot of these sort of politics going on behind the scenes, and the international community is very aware of that because, you know, these MPs are telling them that. So they're briefing against the NUG behind the scenes, and they're waiting for an opportunity for when the military is desperate enough for dialogue, or when the military is defeated or collapsed, and they want to go back and say we were elected and we got the legitimacy. So it's going to be very challenging.
We're talking about the future, right? In order to reach there's still so much we need to do right now. What have you been doing, or what are the works that you've been doing to reach that future that we all hope for, the future without a role of military?
I was for Burma Campaign UK, it's not for us to tell people in the country what to do. We always try and follow the sort of the lead of the movement, and it was very clear after the coup began in 2021, there were five clear things that came across, which deny the military the legitimacy they want, cut off their sources of revenue, cut off their sources of arms, justice and accountability, and humanitarian assistance, support for civil society as well. So these were the five areas that we have been focusing on in terms of advocacy. And we were very successful, not just Burma Campaign UK, but we as in international advocates were very successful at the beginning in getting sanctions on military companies, on getting sanctions on some of the cronies that were involved in supplying arms. And we lobbied at the very beginning to say you can't repeat the mistakes of how sanctions were applied after 88, because there were only about four main rounds of sanctions after 88. And it was always just after there was an atrocity, there was political momentum for the European Union and the US and Australia, Canada to do something, and they would slap on a round of sanctions and then that was it, job done. And so we were saying you can't, that approach isn't effective enough. You need to systematically identify and sanction sources of revenue, arms, equipment, on an ongoing basis. And that did happen for about 3 years. But the last year and a half, actually, it's the pace has gone from a dribble to a trickle. And yeah, there hasn't been the same willingness to keep imposing those sanctions. And you need to do that because, in part, because you just, there's no silver bullet, there's no magic solution in terms of international pressure on the military. You just have to do everything you can to throw sand in the cogs to make life more difficult and harder for them, in the same way that everyone in the country is doing so much that they can in giving their lives and everything to try to resist military rule. And the least the international community can do is just, we'll do our bit by everything we can do to cut off revenue, arms and equipment. We'll try and do our best, and not to impose sort of overall blanket sanctions that's going to hurt the general population, but to keep identifying these sources of revenue and arms and sanctioning them, and to do it on an ongoing basis as well, because the military will find ways around sanctions eventually. So you need to keep, it's like whack-a-mole, as they put, you've got to keep finding where they're doing another route, what they've done now, and sanction that. And the British government, the EU, the US have not been willing to sort of sustain that pressure. So that's a big loss. And that makes life easier for the Burmese military as well.
Right. So more targeted sanctions instead of blanket sanctions that could hurt the people of Burma more.
Yeah. So I think, also, I think there needs to be a willingness. We have seen some Russian companies that supplied aircraft parts to the Burmese military sanctioned, but then Chinese companies supplying whole jets haven't been sanctioned. Vietnamese companies supplying jet fuel have not been sanctioned. So there needs to be a bit more willingness because it's, the soft targets have been sanctioned, and there needs to be a bit more willingness to, to go and sanction third countries which are providing arms and equipment to the military, and which has happened over Ukraine, but isn't happening over the situation in Burma. So yeah, we need to try to increase pressure on governments to do that. Right now, we've had this whole series of blows from the Trump administration on a whole range of areas, but we don't yet know even what their policy is going to be. We haven't seen any significant steps in terms of the policy. Are they going to sort of continue and increase sanctions, or are they going to jump the other way? We just don't know. So that's a big uncertain factor that we've still got as well.
Yeah, it's been a little over 100 days since Trump administration come into power, and already we're seeing so much damage done to in terms of Myanmar, in terms of attention, humanitarian aid, or any kind of support. As the one of the executive order is to cut off the DEI, diversity, equity, and I think inclusivity scholarship for Myanmar students. That includes those at the border who were already enrolled, who were already starting school. So a lot of lives are different now because of this new administration in the United States as well.
Yeah, it's, the list is so long of the negative impacts of Trump administration in terms of media, VOA, but also funding for Burmese media, for the scholarships, for the cuts that have happened with NED, overall humanitarian aid cuts. It's, yeah, and but also stopping finance for some of the think tanks, the USIP, Wilson Center, which, since the coup have been providing important analysis and information, which is informing decision makers and which has been useful. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways, and that we don't even know. You see now, Trump is not just in terms of Ukraine, but in conflicts in Africa. His big thing is you've got to stop fighting, and he wants to end the conflict. You've got to negotiate. You've got to have dialogue. You've got to negotiate, and you've got to stop fighting. But if that happens in Burma, then the military's saved. That's not what people in the country want to happen. And so, some people in the US joke that they want to keep Burma off of his radar because you never know which way he's going to jump. And of course, if Russia have got their ear as well, and Russia is such a strong backer of the Burmese military, then that's a big problem.
But China, US doesn't want China to trump them, So, but China having their claws in Myanmar wouldn't, well, one would think that wouldn't US want more influence or more involvement in Myanmar to counter that?
But the US has gone the opposite way. It's given $9 million in earthquake assistance, and China's given $136 million. They are, they are actually getting rid of their influence in multiple ways with the media cuts and others. But also, you've got some of the right-wing think tanks that have been associated with people around Trump who have been suggesting that the best option to pull Burma away from China is to switch sides and back the Burmese military. So, they've been seriously suggesting that as an option.
That sounds absurd to me.
It's
Like,
absurd,
I mean, it
but
sounds like,
how many observed
yeah.
things has Trump done? So people in the US assure me that that can't or won't happen, but then there's so many things have happened which people have told me can't or won't happen. So you just don't know which way they'll jump. And so we have to just watch very carefully.
But
the Burmese military have, they're back. They're playing a better diplomatic game now. They played it very dumb just before and since the coup, but they seem to be, playing. They're really using the earthquake very effectively for their own benefit. They're having a very good earthquake. They're benefiting in multiple ways from it. And
how do you think they're benefiting? You know, the earthquake was massive, massive damage in 100 years, and so many people are suffering. And also the Myanmar military receive or like welcomes foreign aids, right? And can you clarify on what you mean by like they could be benefiting from the earthquake?
I think where you see the fact that they called for international aid, when people's memories of this sort of similar situation, Cyclone Nargis, is when they wouldn't let aid in. So they're being given a lot of credit for that, that they changed their approach for that, that they have been allowing a certain amount of access. I mean, they turned down some of the Western teams, but a lot of the regional teams from neighboring countries were allowed in. So that's brought them a lot of goodwill internationally. And they've been more cooperative with some of the international aid agencies in where they can have access. Obviously, there's a lot that people don't see. Like we're at our sister organization, Advance Myanmar, which has been providing earthquake relief. We're hearing from people about the obstructions, the difficulties, the challenges, the roadblocks that they've got in trying to deliver assistance. But for the big international agencies, they, obviously they're not trying to get somewhere where they know the military are going to say no, but they are having an easier time of it, is what they're briefing. So the military are getting credit for that. They've milked this for the international legitimacy with managing to secure the ASEAN meetings with Malaysia government, the state media, propaganda channels, military media, full of pictures of phone calls with Minalai's having with different international leaders. So, they've maximized that in terms of their international outreach. And also, there's a feeling among sort of Western countries now, is not the time to sort of step up any criticism, strong criticism too much, or impose new sanctions or anything like that, because we don't want to endanger the access we've got at this time. So they're able to buy some sort of political cover with the earthquake as well. And of course, they've been direct recipients of huge amounts of international aid. Western aid doesn't go through the military or any of the ministries or structures that they control, but regional countries have just been delivering plane loads of aid or sending the government money, the business cronies giving them billions. And of course, they're going to find lots of ways to milk that, whether it's contracts for military owned companies or you name it, they'll find ways to benefit from that money as well, in terms of where it goes, who benefits from it, which companies get the contracts. So it's gone very well for them from an international perspective and a financial perspective. Obviously, domestically, it's going to increase the resentment against the military, because their response has actually been quite pathetic, very limited. Some places they haven't responded at all. So they could have longer term domestic repercussions. But it's not a popular regime anyway. So
what else can we do? Like as our listeners or as friends of Myanmar who wants to help, not just the victims of the earthquake, but also just Myanmar people in general. We're, a lot of people are put in a rock and a hard place to think, like, who do we trust to donate, or do we encourage donation to go to certain people, or what do you think is the best way Friends of Burma can be helpful?
Well, I think especially for sort of communities of people from Burma around the world, I think they do know that organizations, they're supporting PDFs or hospitals or different things, or from different ethnic communities. Obviously, they've got their own civil society and infrastructure. So, and that's been that's been vital, but you know, when the international community hasn't stepped up, this sort of worldwide network of people from the country who have been stepping up and holding so many events and fundraising and giving that money. But I think where we're missing is that coordinated international advocacy to cut off those sources of revenue and arms. And I think it sounds the most boring or obvious thing, but one of the most effective things is contacting your local parliamentarian, congressperson, whatever political system you've got, who your elected representative is. And that's something that Burma Campaign UK has always focused on, because if you've got a parliamentarian who becomes interested and sympathetic, then, you know, when they write to the foreign minister about something, the foreign minister is going to reply to them. They're going to send a letter back. It's not just going to get a stock reply or no reply, like if we write, as individuals. If they can raise questions in parliament, they can talk to other parliamentarians or people in legislatures as well. And if you've got multiple people doing that, then you build up a group of MPs or parliamentarians, where, you know, Congress people, they're building that caucus in the US now. And that can become a really powerful way to influence government policy. Because at the end of the day, there isn't, you know, for Burma, it's not a priority for most Western countries anyway. But if you're a foreign minister, if you're a prime minister, and you've got loads of parliamentarians, and you've got lots of members of the public in your country saying, do this, do this, do this, and it's, you don't care much either way, there's no reason not to do something. You haven't got a big reason not to do something. It's just not a priority to do something. But if you've got parliamentarians and members of the public pressuring you, you can think, well, I can score some easy points here. I can get some popularity points. I can make my political colleagues happy. I can, you know, make constituents happy by doing this at no real political or economic cost. So it's an easy win when you, for politicians to do these things once you've built up that sort of base. So the most important thing, write to whoever your local representative is, ask if you could go and meet them and talk about the situation. Say that more needs to be done to provide humanitarian assistance. Say that more needs to be done to cut off revenue and build that pressure up. That works. That's what Burma Campaign UK has been doing for 25 years. And that's how we get the British government, you know, to act, because you build up, and it takes time, but you build up that support in parliaments, in legislatures, and it puts pressure on governments and they act. It takes time. It's a bit scary. To some people are very nervous just to write out of the blue, but there was one time there was a debate on Burma in the British Parliament, and there was a very senior politician who never showed any interest and who stood up and gave this very passionate speech and really strongly criticizing the government for not doing enough and calling on them to do more. It was, you know, very important. And he said he did that because he had two constituents from Burma came and met him and explained the situation for him. He said, I didn't know anything about Burma or even where it was. But once they told him what was going on and what the British government should be doing and wasn't, he came and made a speech about it and he became engaged. It works.
Yeah, in United States as well, they created this Burma caucus in Congress, you know, bipartisan representatives that focus on Burma issues. And, you know, the co-chair of Burma caucus, Congressman Bill Huizenga, he said that the reason he did it is because of his constituents, you know, mostly, well, for his case, mostly Christians, and he is Republican leaning. So, you know, and there's a lot of constituents write to him, talk to him, and, you know, have lobby in their own ways without even organizational support in, you know, making the United States move, you know, go on with it, do more things, do more sanction, you know. It is, I think everybody, every community, Burmese community abroad is trying to go home in some ways. You know, I have been away from home for so long. And, you know, with the coup and the pandemic and one thing led to another, I haven't been able to go back home in a very long time. And I hope my son one day will be able to go home. I hope it's sooner rather than later. And, you know, I want to encourage all of our listeners to do support in whatever they can to leave Myanmar as a better place for the future generation.
Yeah. People abroad, people from Burma who are abroad, they have enormous power now. They have a lot of power that they can use. And because they've got representatives that they can reach out to. And it's scary. And I think, you know, there are organizations in the UK, people can come to Burma Campaign UK. There's US Campaign for Burma, International Campaign for Rohingya in the US, and many others. If you want support, it can be scary to reach out to someone, but that it's these elected representatives, it's their job. And in most countries, they have an obligation. If you write to them, they're meant to write back. And you can go, and most of them will agree to meet with people in their area. And you can have enormous influence, more than you would have if living in the country. In some cases, in some countries, because you can influence the foreign policy of the country you live in through your elected representative, and doing that through different representatives, building up a body like the caucus you're referring to, it's incredibly powerful. It's really influential. It's the single most effective thing. During the so-called reform process, when Burma Campaign UK, we lost all our grants because we refused to accept that the reform process was genuine, that the military were reforming. We didn't go along with that narrative, so our donors all cut us, and we lost half our staff, but we still kept a parliamentary officer because that is so important. That work is so important for all of the advocacy.
Yeah. Sorry, that's my new boss in the background.
You've been so lucky with none of mine have burst in yet. So,
he's growing rapidly, and this is honestly, I feel like it's an embodiment of my hope for the country. Like I always, trying to get a connection with my country, Burma, even though I've been living abroad for so long. And, this hope that one day all of us can return into Myanmar that we once know, or a better place for us, is what keeps me going.
I think when you talked about I want to go home, and we actually did a campaign in the late 2000s called I Want to Go Home, because that's what everyone from the country told me, and so we had a campaign, I Want to Go Home, where people told their stories, why they ended up in the UK, and that they wanted to go home. And we had, I think we had an event in Parliament where people just held up signs, I want to go home. People protested on the streets in London with a placard saying, I want to go home. It was very powerful because, people, they're thinking about Burma in one way as the military dictatorship and all the things going on there, but to actually see people from the country saying, I want to go home, and it's struck something, I think, with people in the UK, is like, imagine for people here in the UK, the idea that you can't go home is impossible to conceive. And so to see people there saying, I want to go home, and they couldn't, I think that was a very powerful message. And very sad one as well. So
that's a very powerful campaign. That's the idea that resonates with a lot of Burmese people abroad. But on the flip side, the generation that is stuck in the country, and there's conscription law that will make them join the military, that will make them do things that they don't particularly want to do. A lot of people in my generation, older, younger, a lot of people try to do civil disobedient movement, CDM, right after the coup, but somehow some of them quietly have to work again for their survival. And there are still so many of people who, although they want to leave, although they want to stay, there are situations that is not allowing them, you know? So I don't have a solution. I'm hoping we could all come up with a solution, you know, like, I mean, I know that everybody is doing whatever they can to go home or to preserve home as home as we know it should stand.
I think you were talking earlier when you said about the multiple crises, and yeah, and it, you just got, because you know, yeah, like you say, you've had the cyclones, there's floods, there's earthquake, there's the coup, but you know, talking to people in the central part of Myanmar where the, you know, the heat now is so much, they can only grow one crop compared to two a year because of climate change. You know, Burma is the second most vulnerable country in the world for climate change, and that's already hitting. That's why, part of the reason why you've got the storms and the floods and the increased heat as well. And it, you know, there's a real urgency to deal with climate change in the country. It's a desperate situation, and nothing can happen because of the military. And yeah, and so even when you know, even if the military are defeated and you've got all of the challenges to deal with the different ethnic and religious tensions and multiple administrations and everything like that, on top of all of that is going to be, you know, really strong impacts of climate change, more than most other countries are going to experience as well. And you also talk about resilience, and you know, I think, you know, I've seen people saying it more publicly, but people are telling, we're not resilient, we just have no other choice, we have no no options at all, you know, and we're left alone to do it. And I have, you know, when I was at the development agency, Christian Aid, I did travel around the world a bit. And I do have to say that having been to several countries, you know, people from Burma, they really do step up. They're not waiting for anyone to solve problems for them, like I have seen a bit in some other countries. They're not waiting for aid agencies or UN or someone to come and help. You know, immediately they set up organizations, they work together to try and solve problems in the most impossible situations every single time. And that is really remarkable. But I don't know if you'd call that resilience when there is no other choice, but certainly it is inspiring to see over and over again, despite everything, people not giving up and in the worst kind of situations. And you kind of think you can't, yeah, you can't stop because the problem hasn't gone. And when I started at Burma Campaign UK, and after about 3 years, people saying, isn't it time you moved on? You should go to another organization, or people would just think of you as a Burma person and it won't be good for your career. But I said, well, the problem hasn't gone, so I can't go.
Yeah. Well, we thank you for staying on with as friends of Myanmar, you know?
It's easy for me. I have a choice, you know. You don't have a choice. People from the country have no choice.
Yeah, that's why being called resilient is easy for somebody, an outsider, to call it. But when people don't have a choice, what choice do they have but to survive? Yeah. And, you know, with the earthquake, with limited resources, the military said they're helping, but the aid never came to most of them. So what I notice is that in communities, they all come together, and, you know, one person from central Myanmar, their house collapsed. Some family members were stuck and they were forced to live on the street, and they don't have anything, right? So they have to give the priority to the grandpa, grandma, and the babies to sleep inside the mosquito net. They only have time to bring one or two that they have, and they were sleeping in there. And a few days later, or maybe the next day, there were private donors that came and distributed mosquito nets with their own money. They were helping, and that was not on a large scale or any foreign aids or any institutional help at all. It's just people who had more just thought they should share, and nobody was telling them what to do, but they just happened to help build each other's houses. And, you know, from an outsider's perspective, they see this as like, wow, you know, it's just like, I'm sure it looks like this picture perfect situation, but what choice do they really have but to help each other? You know, we are, and I personally, I want to be the country of Burma to be seen as a victim all the time. The people are resilient, but also they want to live. They want to thrive more than survive. You know, that is like, if you ask me, that's the future of Myanmar that I'm striving to see.
I think it, when we, because obviously the main area where the earthquake is in central parts of the country, but we knew that there were impacts across the country, and we reached out to sort of some of the civil society groups working in different parts of the country just to make sure, like, you know, what's the impact of the earthquake there. And what was remarkable is there's some from a long way away, organizations where in their own states, in their own areas, the situation is dreadful. And we were saying, yeah, is there an impact there? Do you need help? And they said, oh, not an impact here, but we've already sent some people. They're on their way to Sagay now. They were like hundreds and hundreds of miles away. And they straight away, they sent people there to go and help. And, you know, when they had nothing themselves, when they, you know, have a dreadful situation with, you know, conflict and IDPs in their own areas and others, and were still sending teams to help. It was, yeah, remarkable.
Yeah. Out of all the one after another crisis that Myanmar faced, I want to end on this hopeful note. And I want to thank you for all that you are doing for Burma. And I know it's part of the many hats you wear, and, you know, your beginning as part of a protest leading to how you got into Myanmar, and for sticking with it. Like you said, the problem hasn't gone away, and we don't want to be forgotten. And so if we need to do another parade and, you know, get the international media attention, just like in the 90s way, to for people to not forget about Myanmar, I'm sure a lot of people are willing to do that.
I think so. I think it's inevitable that people of Burma will win their freedom, and we just have to make sure the international community does as much as it can to make sure that we help the people bring that about as sooner rather than later.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. This was a real conversation between two individuals. That may sound like a self-evident or rather strange thing to emphasize, but in a world increasingly dominated by AI-generated content and short-form pieces designed just to grab clicks, we're proud to offer something genuine. Our podcast platform is built around long-form conversations. Real, meaningful dialogue between individuals who sit down to speak at length about important issues. These are not rushed, surface-level exchanges. They're deeply human interactions that take time, care, and effort to produce. And there are no shortcuts to creating this kind of content. Each episode requires research, preparation, recording, editing, and careful curation to ensure that the voices and stories we share truly resonate. It's a labor of love, but it does come with real costs. Costs that reflect the care, time, and energy it takes to prioritize depth over brevity and substance over spectacle. If you value this approach and want to help us continue creating these conversations, please consider supporting our work. Your support allows us to uphold this commitment to quality and authenticity, ensuring that these stories remain accessible in a world that so often prioritizes shortcuts. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to make a contribution.